We have part one of the study, Rome versus Jesus Christ. We'll ask Brother Kevin Turner, please, to read for us Daniel chapter 8. Ask Brother Pierce to give us the first part of our study, Rome versus Jesus Christ.
Brothers and sisters, it's a very dramatic statement, really, isn't it? The climax of world history, Christ comes. And also, it is a dramatic proposition for each of us. We realise that when Christ comes, this is the most important day in our lives. For every one of us will then stand before our Master in the great and solemn day of inspection, to see whether we are fit to partake of the divine nature and enter into this glorious age for which we look and long for. As we shall have the phrase in our second address, Revelation 16, I come as a thief, blessed is he that watcheth, lest he be found naked, spiritually naked. And the prophetic word is valuable to us if it helps us to watch. No use if we just find it interesting and it doesn't affect our lives. All the way through history, God has graciously provided his servants with guidelines as to what should happen. We remember particularly how the Lord Jesus gave to the disciples in their day a very detailed outline of the Mount Olivet prophecy, those things that would lead up to the end of events in the Mosaic economy. And again, and then he said, watch, for I come as a thief. In other words, these outline of events were to keep us expectant and so stirred up to have our loins girded and waiting for the Lord. So all I say this evening, you may find it interesting, I hope even exciting, but let us see, it is only to stir us up in spiritual things. Now, first half, we're going to be looking at prophecies in Daniel. So the question is, what can Daniel tell us about the present and the immediate future? He certainly speaks of the things that belong to the latter days, time of the end, and phrases like that, which show that the prophecies are intended to present us information about the end of all the sequences described there. We shall look chiefly at chapters 7 and 8, but just for a moment in Daniel chapter 2, so well known to us, just to make the comment that we're so used to using that to demonstrate to people who haven't much faith in the Bible that in those different metals we have a sequence of world empires. That was not the main purpose of the prophecy. It was, as we read, to tell Nebuchadnezzar and those who now read the record what shall be in the latter days. And what shall be in the latter days is a vast image, all those parts integrated together, to be smitten on the feet by the little stone power and to be crushed and driven away as chaff. Indicating therefore that there is to be a great conflict when Christ returns between the human powers that govern the world and our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, rather than to just give us some idea, it's just that great image standing upon Rome and on Constantinople. So, moving from that chapter 2 to chapter 7, we have there more detail of this conflict and what it's about. Again, we will know it well enough that it has the four beasts that correspond with the four metals of Daniel chapter 2 and again represent the four world empires. What is important is to see first that it is nearly all about the fourth beast. It doesn't bother itself much about the other three. So the fourth beast empire that spreads for so long a time. And that we can realise is the Roman Empire by comparison, at least with the Daniel chapter 2. So we are considering then this fourth beast, which from Book of Revelation we will deduce that it is somewhat like a dragon. That doesn't matter very much. What a terrible beast, as that describes. And we shall be interested in two particular parts, a little horn that comes up, and with brazen claws, the horn and the brazen claws. So that world empire, we well know, is represented on a map we're all used to by a very vast area. The main shaded part is representing the Roman Empire, about AD 300, I suppose. It did, in fact, at some time extend right down into the Middle East. And the spotted area is just to indicate that as time went on, the Roman Empire and its influence and its system spread from the west up into Germany and the Rhineland, and in the east up into Russia and the Slav countries. So clearly you can include the whole of that as representative by the Roman power as it fully developed. The matters which we are going to consider then, perhaps we'll just note the sequence of events in the chapter first. First we have, just in green, to make it clear to us that in those three items, this is chief. This is not the whole chapter, it's just selected verses you can see. It emphasises that it is mostly about the fourth beast. Fourth beast is introduced. Even when the Ancient of Days comes, it's still there, and is the fourth beast as the one destroyed. It's a beast, a system, a world system, that according to Daniel carries right through history. And the second thing that this chapter highlights, even more than that, is that the dominant element in this fourth beast system is this little horn that we've briefly referred to. So we mention it here as first being coming on the scene. Again, it is even there when Christ returns and the Ancient of Days sits, that's Jesus Christ returning as the Father's representative. It is there speaking great words. As one reads through the chapter, you have step by step an enlarging in interpretation. He wants to know the meaning of this fourth beast, little horn. And the little horn is described as a great power, with speaking great words, a stout look, and it wears out the saints. It has conflict with the saints. The whole chapter really is emphasizing a conflict between an aspect of the Roman power represented by a little horn, in which it wears out, destroys the saints for a long period of time, and then a reversal of the situation when Christ returns, the saints take the kingdom and destroy the little horn. That's the whole pattern of this book, of this chapter. So our interest then is to say, what can we learn from such a brief glance at Daniel chapter 7 relative to the present? Well, some very important and simple matters that can't be controverted. First, that clearly, as we just looked at the transparency, the fourth beast power is there when Christ returns. The Roman system, which we know about so well in the past, must be there when Christ returns. I'm going to put it on again just to be absolutely, make it really clear of what we're talking about. You see, there it is. Ancient of Days returns, and this fourth beast is to be destroyed at that time. So we can deduce from that we are to expect the whole of the European world to be bound together again and a reconstituted Roman power to exist at the time when Christ comes. We should be able to follow that through in the present time. But something equivalent to the whole of the old Roman Empire is to be reconstituted, representing indeed that great image which you looked at in Daniel chapter 2. That's the first, most important guideline we can have at the present time and leading into the future. Second, that this little horn power, whatever it is dominant right through history, wearing out the saints, from God's point of view, it doesn't matter about anything else, from God's point of view, wearing out the saints, changing the law, speaking against God. And it's there doing the same thing when Christ returns. There it is. It speaks great, a bit higher up. the great words which the little horn spake. When Christ is here, the chief opponent, the voice of antagonism with Christ is from the little horn. So it's something to look at. So what is this little horn? It represents, if we examine it carefully, I might have much time to go into a lot of detail with this sketch this evening. It does represent the what we call the Roman Catholic, the papal system supported by civil power, by an emperor. You can only need to ask, historically speaking, what is the power that has worn out the saints for a long time, a three and a half period, three times and a half. And though some today, I know, are trying to make this 3.5 years, that doesn't make sense. The very word wearing out is absolutely the correct sense of the Hebrew here. And wearing out is a word that expresses a long period of activity, not just a brief year or two's activity. Wearing out for a time, times, the dividing of times. The little horn, of course, is itself combines both a temporal, civil, military power as a horn, that's what a horn means, a rulership. And this horn is most peculiar because not only does it have a mouth that speaks great things, but it has eyes like the eyes of a man. And I think that is the one pinpointing element of the prophecy that directs our attention to the Roman Catholic system. Well, this is most remarkable, but its control spreads out throughout all the world, more or less today, in every country, wherever there is a church, whatever village, town or country it may be, there is the priest, there is the confessional. There is the priest knowing all about the people who are in the Catholic system. Even the most high and mighty men are Catholics, they're known about. And they priests are the eyes of the church. They know. This is why it is so powerful, why they can influence what is done in world politics, why they can intrigue as they do. Eyes like the eyes of a man. Eyes of all-seeing power, which attributes only to the Catholic Church. You could not find any other system which could have those words applied to them. But also go into history, which I mustn't do, to show how the little horn arising after 10 horns does fit in with the uprising of the papacy after the barbarians invaded Western Europe and Christianity spread into the West and the papal power, supported by the emperor Charles Pepin and Charlemagne, grew over those periods and onwards to be so mighty. And to have the phrase, a voice, a stout look and a strong voice, we only need to read the decrees in the 12th and the 13th centuries against the heretics, which were the saints, of course, you to see what power was there. Dreadful records they were, and our brethren suffered tremendously, torture and death and many other evils. So, again, just accepting my brief sketch of that, we are to look, come to the present now, for the Vatican power to be strong and effective and outstanding voice when Christ comes. Those who are trying to tell us it will have been destroyed by a beast or this way or that, but just off the mark. The chief opponent, the chief voice against Christ is the little horn power, the Roman Catholic power, supported, of course, by military power. And again, we shall be able to see how that is developing at this present time in a moment. The third thing that's significant and useful from this very brief look at Daniel chapter 7 are those brazen claws. Quite a remarkable statement. It, in the first place, destroyed this great power, devoured the earth with its great iron teeth. Iron represents the basic Roman power, as you have it more particularly in the Latin countries. But in the residue, at the end of time, are not to be destroyed. The military power isn't in the teeth, but it's in brazen claws. In other words, a beast can destroy with its teeth, it can destroy with its claws. The destroying power, the military power, is brazen claws. Now, brass, we will all recognise, represents the Grecian side of things. Now, the Roman Empire indeed had, for a long time, two parts, the Latin West and the Grecian East. And indeed, the Grecian cultural influence dominated in the Roman Empire all the way through. And historically, we are used to the Eastern Byzantine Empire, somewhat different from the Western side, which we know much better. Ruling from Constantinople, the emperor was in Constantinople for long, long centuries, governing the Roman world. So this is telling us that we are to look for the military power to be eastern in the Roman Empire. Doesn't that fit with our general concept of Russia moving into Europe in due course, confederating it all together, but the military power being established in the east, the brazen Grecian side of the empire? So we sketch straight away some important statements. All Europe to be bound together again, including some of the Middle East, and the united whole country, a vast area, under the control on the religious side of the Little Horn, the Roman Catholic power, and on the military side, are dominated by the Russian military power, having moved into the Roman Empire. So against that sketch, we can look very briefly at what has been happening. We're well acquainted with the so-called Iron Curtain, which has been there for so long, and people are so used to East and West being apart from one another. But those who have been watching carefully, as the Bible students should do, have been quite aware of how a change has been going on. Because first of all, after the Second World War, we have Russia moving into Eastern Europe, the satellite countries, and so quite properly Russia can be regarded as a European country. But speaking of the West was supported and maintained by America, and they were very glad to have all the support they could get, both militarily in NATO and in finance and commerce from the United States. But as time has been going on over the last 20 years, one can trace how the Western Europe has becoming more and more independent, and a degree of antagonism, which I think probably everyone in this room is now conscious of, between Europe, Western Europe, and America, and a general movement of the Western Europe towards the Soviet. It goes right back to the time of de Gaulle, 1963, when he said to NATO, "Get out of France, we don't want you," and NATO, and they separated themselves out of NATO and moved the NATO headquarters from France to Belgium. And it was de Gaulle who made the first move of accommodation, degree of friendship with the Soviets. He visited Kremlin. Khrushchev came to Paris. And this relationship, special relationship between France and the Soviet goes back to this 1863-65 time. My date's a bit wrong, actually. 58, I think, was when they came out, the NATO came out. So that started this relationship of the West with the East. It was de Gaulle who used the now classic phrase, to those who take any notice, when he said he looked for a Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. He could see it was going to come to pass. No doubt he was working very sensibly to integrate France in favourable terms with the Soviet. Then you come to the time of Willy Brandt, 69, the socialist government for the first time in Germany. He made his treaties with Russia, first of all, 1970, with Eastern Germany, 1971, and various trade treaties with the rest of Eastern Europe. So from both those main headquarters, a movement was underfoot based largely upon trade. And you can run through the 1970s on the keynote of détente, which from the Russian point of view was a very nice development to bring that cooperation they wanted. And from the Western point of view, they liked it because it allowed the development of trade. The big industrial leaders of Western Germany could get their basic resources from the Soviet and hand back manufactured goods. And this is most important in the way Western Germany is and will be integrated with Russia. Trade ties countries together. You get so involved in the give and take and the movement of goods and money that you don't fight when you've made those close links. And so we come to the 1979, when the unexpected invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets shocked Carter so much, he said in 1 week his eyes had been opened. His eyes, of course, ought to have been opened all the way along. But he suddenly realised that the Soviet was an aggressive, expanding power, and before he passed off the presidential scene, he had inaugurated a vast military development and demanded of the countries of Western Europe that they would carry out economic sanctions against the Soviet because of the Afghanistan invasion. And what happened? Oh, just a bit of lip service from France and from Germany. And in fact, at the very time when those sanctions were asked for, they were signing treaties in Kremlin for more trade. They were not going to get involved in that sort of sanctions. Carter passing off the scene, Reagan comes on the scene, a man of stronger antagonism to the Soviet, and he augmented the moves that Carter had started. And you come into a period, our own period, which is called the period of confrontation. Reagan's concept is of confrontation, both economically, militarily, and politically. And this is growing very strongly. The outlooks of America and Western Europe are quite different. America, at a distance, looks at things globally and sees Western Europe as one barrier. Mediterranean is another barrier. Middle East is another barrier. Far East is another barrier. She's involved in all these containment positions against the Soviet. And Western Europe is just one of them. And containment, in this sense of confrontation, is the only thing she sees to hold the Russians in check. Western Europe doesn't look at it like that at all. They're right on the doorstep of this massive power. They don't want war on their war again. They've had war through all the centuries. And one thing they don't want is war. They'll give anything not to have war. And so the whole spirit of neutrality and peace and so on dominates more and more. Militarily, the military people know that they should be strong, but the people at large, we must surely have read so many times, don't want it. And so they seek, by this continuing sense of détente, of trade and cooperation, to damp down and to be friendly with the Soviet so that things are not too bad. A little detail of recent times to impress on you how things move all the time to the Soviet and Western Europe being drawn together. We know not exactly how. Last year, beginning the year before that, you'll remember this question of the Siberian pipeline bringing oil, gas more particularly, right from 3,000 miles right into Western Europe, dividing out into all the countries. And America was very pointedly opposed to it. Right up to the very last minute, she did her very best to prevent the agreement being made. And when it was made, what did she do? She said, "We'll stop it." She called for sanctions so emphatically that she said her big industrialists who licensed Western Europe to make all the special equipment said, "You're not going to have your license to do it." And what happened in the Western Europe? They defied America. They said, "We will do it. It's our interest to do it." And Reagan had to back down. The first time there was an absolute clash of interests between Western Europe and America. And from that point onwards, you can sketch as many things as you like. All last year, in the book, latest milestones, there's a whole catalogue of all the oppositions. In fact, the most up-to-date ones I've just got on two cuttings here. 30th of April, 83, Euro anger at Reagan trade plan. 2nd of May, US will maintain hard line on trade with Russia. And so, in all the things that really make up life, there's a totally different outlook economically. But it's militarily, of course, where the real clash comes. Oh, well, the whole question must have read about the placing of the cruise and Pershing 2 missiles in Western Europe to balance the SAM-20s that are so prolific on the other side. And whereas Western Europe wished for this at one time, now it's near to come. You will have read of all the opposition there is amongst the common people, the people of Western Europe, Western Germany particularly, to oppose it. In other words, they don't want nuclear war on their territory. And this is an important matter from a Russian point of view, you know, and that's to try and be objective. These Pershing missiles would take only 6 minutes. They travel at 1,000 miles an hour, and they would take only 6 minutes to get right onto Russian targets. And they'd have no time at all to counter them, and they're very accurate. And Russia really is afraid of the Pershing missiles. And Western Europe is taking the view, if we do this, it will be an unfriendly act towards the Soviet. We don't know what she might do. She might attack us there and then. That is the spirit which is developing in Western Europe. Then remember also, from the political point of view, that most of, really all Western Europe is all socialist or communist. France is so nearly communist. West Germany's been socialist for so long. Spain, Portugal, Norway. They, because they are socialist in outlook, they have a much greater affinity with the Soviet system, Marxism, than ever is apparent in this country. And they don't see things as being too bad. They overlook the things that might frighten them. So there's a whole spirit that's been developing and now standing out. And it's all in the direction that the Soviet tries to move it. How, indeed, the Soviet will take over, we do not know exactly. Whether there may be a degree of war, we can be quite sure it won't be nuclear war. The Soviet has no wish to destroy Western Europe. She wants it. It's a rich ground of industrial provision and agricultural provision. It is the delightful country, very different to the northern regions where she is. She wants to preserve it whole. It's been described as a ripe plum ready to fall into the lap of the Soviet. She wants to take it over and use it. So it will come about largely by perhaps threats and blackmail, what the Vatican will do and what West Germany will do, we don't know in detail. But this is obvious to us now, that it's all moving in the direction that Western Europe will be brought over into the orbit of the Soviet and separated from America. Britain will then be a little island in great distress, no doubt, on the outskirts of this vast hostile power. That is another question. So, we can see at least that what I outlined from Daniel chapter 7 is moving in that direction. We live in the times of the reconstitution of the Roman world system, Roman system again. A second point was emphasising the importance of the Vatican system as a great power, and I suppose we're all quite conscious of the way in which the present Pope John II is become quite a world leader, trotting from place to place, saying such remarkable things, getting the hearts of all knows how many people, all in the name of Christ and all in the name of good things and justice and peace. So he talks about that one can see the system isn't declining at all, is it? It's growing in world power. Many are a little surprised at the emphasis I give that there is to be cooperation between the Soviet and the Vatican. Yet there it is in the symbolism. Symbolism says so, so it shall be. A fourth beast with brazen claws and a little horn speaking great things. Those are parts of the Roman system. They will be there. And indeed, if one has been following carefully over quite a period of time, this degree of arm's length cooperation, if we can put it that way, they're not friends, of course, but it'll be to their mutual advantage to work together, one on the religious plane and the other on the military-civil plane. After the French Revolution, in the last century, which attacked, of course, the Roman Catholic system, and she suffered so much at the hands of the democracy and the people, she was against socialism, democracy, communism through all the last century. But as the century came towards its end, she realised that things were never going to be pushed back into the old order of things, and typical of her eternal existence, as it may seem, she realised she must move over to the position of embracing in some measure the party of the people, socialism in some form. And in fact, the first encyclical in that direction was 1893, far back as that, when the Catholic Church espoused the working class people. Very interesting document. Nevertheless, in the first part of the 20th century, she still was strongly anti-communist into the Second and Third World Wars. And then, as after the Second World War, she had failed again to win Europe and then to conquer Russia, as she hoped to do, she'd lost the second time, it was realised that she must now move much more actively into the orbit of Russia. The Soviet was becoming the world dominant power. She could see that, and she was on the wrong side. The change came when Pius XII passed off the scene in 1958, and John 23rd came along, a man selected for this new move. And first of all, he issued in 1861 another encyclical. I have it here in fact. No, doesn't matter. New Light on Social Problems, it's called. But it's remarkable, liberal, statement of how the church was in favour of the people and democracy and socialism and welfare and everything that we associate with the people of the world today and socialism. Of course, with the church involved, in other words, they would have to what you might call Catholic communism as distinct from Marxist communism, if you might put it in bold terms. Then it was at the end of his reign, John 23rd, another encyclical called Peace on Earth, as it was called, at the end of that, a very significant two or three paragraphs, where he said that whereas we are opposed to the doctrine of communism, there is no reason why we should not have practical cooperation with communism. That was the key phrase. That was the changeover. And from then on you can trace the way in which a degree of cooperation has been developing. He was replaced by Paul VI. His reign of 15 years was called the East Drive, the East Politic Drive. There was the Vatican Council that gave to the church its modern look and its tolerance. Liberty, equality, fraternity almost became its own jargon. Cooperation with the Soviets became apparent, with important men moving, coming from the Kremlin to the Vatican to the Kremlin, a coming and a going which had never existed before. An agreement that when heads had to be elected in the various satellite states, if it was the Archbishop, then the Kremlin had a say in it. If it was a commissar, then the papacy had a say in it. There was a degree of trying to work together, and the climate of Eastern Europe in that sense changed. Priests were trained in Marxism to go out into the rest of the world. The concept that the gospel was really akin to communism for the good of the people. All this kind of movement went on. Italy, all the mayors of most of the cities were now communists, yet they were also Catholic and went to Mass. The Pope was quite friendly with them. A big change went on, which maybe not many people noticed, but very important. The present Pope coming on the scene has called a halt to that. He's quite opposed to this leftist movement. He's pulling the church back to its doctrinaire position. He's restating the doctrines, which are important for the Catholic faith. He wants to be in as strongest position as possible, standing on his own ground when the day of agreement has to come between two powers that are not real friends. It's rather like two businesses finding it necessary to merge together. They're not real friends, are each battling to get the top position. And so it will be. And you can look on Poland over the last year or two as the crucible in which all this is being worked out. The hostility, the cooperation. Those two things are working all the time. The Catholic power is so strong there that the communist side can't squeeze it out. And they have to reluctantly let the Pope come again and open up the way to go where he wants to go. Yet they're trying to stamp out the movement into a solidarity, real communist point of view. And you will find that here is being worked out the clash of powers, that they both will eventually find it better than to fight, oppose each other, to pull together in taking over Western Europe and world conquest as far as they will see it. So again, things have moved a long way, and all in harmony with the few brief little phrases that are found in Daniel chapter 7 that we have looked at. So, Daniel chapter 2, a great conflict when Christ returns. Daniel chapter 7, the picture of the hostility through a long centuries, and again the great clash, and who will be involved in the great clash. We can next ask the question, where? Where will this great conflict have its initiation? We can move now to Daniel chapter 8. In fact, 8 to the end will give us that picture as briefly as I can. Perhaps I should just comment that you can divide Daniel's prophecy into two parts. Chapters 1 to 7 are on a world scale, just as chapter 7 is on a European world scale. When you come to chapter 8, and its sequence that runs right through to chapter 12, it's a different picture. It is all to do with Israel and their land. And now we're going to see in chapter 8 how the same Roman power has been hostile to all things to do with Israel the nation and Israel the land, and the sequence that will be the ultimate at the time when Christ comes. So there is picking out what is important to us again. We mustn't go through the whole chapter. You've got the goat that comes along and destroys the ram, and it has a bold horn. This was a Grecian power. That was Alexander the Great, which we read of so much in history. And after his brief rule, his kingdom was divided to his four generals. Four horns come up. Two are important. We should come to that in a moment. And then after that, there is a little horn springing out of one of them, the northern horn, but it's called a little horn of the goat. Clearly the language is it becomes very great. And we have no difficulty in identifying again, just using different symbols for the Roman power, the little horn of the goat. Different symbols are used because it's dealing with the Roman power from another angle, its eastern angle and its impact upon the land of Israel. And so the goat is used, the little horn, and we have it an interpretation in that chapter. We had it read that the Grecian, the goat is Greece, and after that is this little horn, which is a great power, which must follow on to be the Roman power. And it is described here in the language of being the king, and it is expressive of its power destroying the holy people. In other words, this is the Roman power in its opposition to the nation of Israel. Well, that's the essence of what we want to look at in chapter 7, or chapter 8. Just highlighting the hostility. Better to look at the screen and look. That's the first part we've looked at already. Now, first of all, chapter verse 10. Rome suppresses Israel's army. Most important, he magnifies himself to, or both those are either to or against, as you'll see from the margin. He magnifies himself against the Prince of the Host, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Cast down the veil, that is when they destroyed the sanctuary, the day of sacrifice ceased. Cast down the truth to the ground, persecuting the Christian believers. I thought I had something to put across there. Yeah, it's buckling up. Right. And the last phrase there is, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And verse 25, that he shall destroy many, which you'll come to in a moment. So there, it's just highlighting, just remind you, of the various ways in which the pagan Roman Empire power was antagonistic to the nation of Israel, to Christ, the sanctuary cast down, the truth oppressed, persecuting the saints. For a long period of time. That was to go on for a long period of time. Perhaps get that thought across as well. The vision, understand the vision, it is going right to the time of the end. So what we've got in Daniel chapter 8 carries us right through from the time of Christ to the time of the end. Similar phrase, verse 19, to tell him what shall be in the last end of the indignation, or at the time a point of the end shall be. So it's something that's going to go right on to the end. A little earlier verse speaks of the downtreading of the city for a long period of time, 2,300 days is not in it, for 2,300. And the last phrase here, it is for many days, and Daniel fainted because it was so long. So there is an indication that this downtreading, or that's the indignation, the wrath of God against Israel, is for a long time. that's the bottom of this one, I guess. What is the end of the indignation? Here is the phrasing, the next last verse. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes. This power, this king power, it says the Roman power is called a king, or the king. Not meaning one person, but king could rather be kingship or rulership. He shall stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. So whereas he destroyed, put to death, crucified, the prince of the host, Jesus Christ, long ago, he's to be there, this same power, to stand up against the prince of princes and be broken without hand, a miraculous destruction, something that must relate to the all-powerful Jesus Christ return to the earth. So we can deduce from what we've read there, briefly again, it reinforces what we had in Daniel chapter 7, that the Roman power is there right back in the days of Christ and is still there when he returns. So it's got to be reconstituted. And likewise, that it is a long period of distress to the nation of Israel, as in chapter 7 it was a long period of his distress at the hands of the Roman power against the saints. And as you follow through history, you find that they both suffered in the same way, especially from the Roman Catholic power and its laws. So chapter 7 is dealing with the saints in Europe. Chapter 8 is dealing with the land of Israel and the people of Israel, the Jews scattered abroad. And the end of the matter, the end of the indignation, this power opposes Christ and is destroyed miraculously. Where will this conflict take place? We'd expect it to be in Israel, if Israel has been the target of this hostility. And as we read on from chapter 8, we find the presentation more or less as a sequence, so that particularly chapter 11 we find as a filling out of giving more detail of what we have in this chapter 8 which we had read. Chapter 7 actually is important because it introduces Jesus Christ, the Messiah, who should be cut off, after which the desolation of Israel would take place. And then in chapter 10, Daniel is told that he is to be told, "What shall befall thy people in the latter days?" It's important, you see, although it fills in things before the latter days, it is telling us, it's going to give us a record that takes us right through to the latter days or the time of the end. And that is what chapter 11 does for us. So in chapter 11 we're going to see, putting it parallel with chapter 8, or part of chapter 8, something of a sequence of how the indignation, the downtreading against Israel has occurred. The chapter is in three parts, if we were to examine it in detail. The first part is 35 verses, a detailed statement of what happened in the land of Israel in times BC, a very troublesome, distressing time for the land of Israel, the king of the north and the king of the south moving to and fro through the land, the city itself invested, statue of Jupiter put in the most holy place. They had a very unhappy time. And the picture could be very briefly presented just with a map, without going into any detail. There's what we've had at the top. But there was for several centuries this, a king of the north and a king of the south, the Seleucidae and the Ptolemies in Egypt, warring with each other, crisscrossing through the land of Israel and bringing desolation to Israel. So that was part one of the indignation or downtreading against Israel. Part two is the middle part, just a few verses of the book, where it deals with the Roman power opposing Israel, downtreading it, and picks up the important phrase of Daniel chapter 8, "And the king shall do thus and thus." So there's only just a few verses of Daniel chapter 11. And the way in which that power in chapter 8, the Roman power, is called the king, can't go into detail as to how that king links with other verses in Scripture, but it's the ruling power for a long time. Quite suddenly, comes into the text, and the king prospers, and also indicates here how he changes his character. He honours a god, a new god whom his fathers knew not. With a strange god whom he shall acknowledge will increase with glory. Exactly what happened when paganism was taken over and Christianity took its place from Constantine onwards. Little phrases dropped in from God's point of view, the important things, you see. It's a power, it prospers. It becomes Catholic. A new god, a new false Christianity is adopted into the Roman system. Still the Roman power, another phase of it. Another important thing expressed about it is that it shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. To begin with Daniel chapter 8, where it's to be there to stand up against the prince of princes and be destroyed without hand. Here it's saying, right, it's going to prosper, be powerful, become Roman Catholic, be powerful, right up to the end of God's indignation against Israel. So we come to the third part of this indignation against Israel, which we are more interested in, the time of the end, last part of the indignation against Israel, when their land is invaded again and all has been swept away, so that they have to cry unto God and Jesus Christ, Michael the Great Prince, saves them. And we know the sequence of this chapter of how the power spreads down, right down to Jerusalem, plants its tabernacle in the most holy place. And the language here picks up the language of the first part as a king of the north and a king of the south, telling us that what we're used to historically, that first map I showed you, some replica of that is to be reinstated at this time when Christ comes. We'll be able to look and just see how that's taking place today. What I want to get across to you now, just at this point, is though, that so often one hears brethren referring to the King of the North just as Russia. It will be Russia as a military leader. But as we've seen, Russia will take over the whole of Europe. It's all going to be bound together, become that great image. And as this language says, that Roman power is to prosper right to the end, not disappear. So that, as we read in chapter 40 here, it is to overflow, the northern power overflows through many countries. So that when the invasion of the land of Israel takes place, all Europe has been brought together. It's not just Russia coming down to take a spoil, but it involves the whole of Europe with its military power, its religious outlook. You can describe it as also a crusade, as well as this coming to take a spoil. This must be so, because this chapter is parallel with chapter 8, they stand up against the prince of princes, destroyed without hand. Here this runs parallel, that this king power is to prosper right till the end of the nation. It's there, and so it's integrated into the king of the north. It's all merged together as one great power coming down on the land. Now, there's quite a lot of importance in this, and I think it's helpfully expressed by another quotation, which comes from Isaiah. This is my emphasis, that when there is the invasion of the land of Israel from the north, it's not just Russia coming to take a spoil, but it has a religious aspect, Christian so-called, against Jew, a crusade. And Isaiah chapter 34 is dealing with all nations gathered there. It's a great gathering. We're told very definitely where they are gathered to in the land of Israel. To what? Bosra. It's described as a gigantic sacrifice of human flesh. It's a terrible destruction in the land of Israel. It's even pinpointed as Bosra or Edom, south of east of Jerusalem. But the key verse is the one at the bottom, I've underlined in red, that it is the day of the Lord's vengeance and the year of the recompense for the controversy of Zion. Now, what I've been talking to you for the last three quarters of an hour is about the controversy of Zion. Zion stands for everything to do with God. the land, the holy nation, the city, the truth, the saints, they all are always summed up in that one word, Zion. And all through the ages there has been the conflict, the hostility of nations, particularly the Roman Catholic nation, Roman power, against the things of God, right up to the present, despising his word, despising his promises, hostile to the things that are to take place. That's gone on through long centuries. And this says that the beginning of the recompense, the answer to all this, is to take place in Bosra, the first great blow that answers the wickedness that's been against all the things of God, is in the land of Israel at Bosra. That's a very important verse and makes it clear that when the great Armageddon conflict takes place, it's not just a question of Ezekiel 38 from that angle of military, of material spoil, but it is the European system in conflict with the Jewish Zion position and the Lord Jesus Christ. Just to round off this first part, hardly need to do so, but bring it into context with where we stand relative to what we've been talking about. We've seen then from Daniel chapter 7 that there must develop, before these great events take place, a new situation in the Middle East. Israel is back in there, and that's marvellous. But also that in some way a replica of the old King of the North, King of the South, must emerge again. Is it emerging? Surely it is. This is one of the most remarkable things that we see in our very recent times. In other words, putting it in map form, there is the original King of the North, King of the South. Here we have got the development, the northern side of Syria particularly, Iran, Iraq in the south, Egypt particularly, and the other countries of Saudi Arabia. And that is the pattern of things that we see emerging in the very days in which we live. A king of the south power, a king of the north power. After America, who's had made Iran its main base of hope to protect the south, had collapsed, she was left with Saudi Arabia, and so she moved over to Egypt, and it was Carter who stirred up Sadat to go to Jerusalem, which was that great event that led to the Israel-Egyptian treaty in 1979. When this was completed, then it was open for the United States to give her aid to Egypt, pouring in arms and materials, exercises with the troops, and a general grip, through a cooperation, best to say, between Egypt and the US. Now, just highlighting one item only, which is quite significant, this Israel-Egyptian treaty required that Israel evacuate the whole of Sinai. When it was to be evacuated, which happened in 1981, there was needed by both sides a safeguard, a protecting line between the two so that they'd feel safe against attack one from the other. And so it came about, without as it were asking for it, that America found herself placing permanently soldiers in Egypt on this line of barrier between the two. A marvellous event, what she'd been wanting, seeking bases and ground positions for several years. And by this, probably she was behind the way it was worked out, most of the 3,000 soldiers are armed, three battalions, are nearly all American. That gives you, that's of course the area that was taken over and now has been evacuated. And there are two battalions up here, a battalion down at this key position in the south, naval vessels patrolling the Gulf. She's taken over the two great air bases which have been built by the Americans and the Israelis at Etzion and Etiam, some of the two most modern air bases there are. She has her reconnaissance planes all the time going over this region. She's installed there. A marvellous event which helps her so much. And taking just a broader look than that, widening the position from Egypt itself. You note I chose this because it said Soviet economic position in 1970. And all these little black squares were positions where the Soviet had its basis and strength. They've all largely disappeared. It's been pushed back. And where all these red spots are, you have bases, another one down here, which are operated by the United States. So very clearly there is a South power developed. Britain's played quite a part in it as well. And what of the North? Just the same emphasis is there. Surely have been reading about what's happened in Syria and the Lebanon war the last year, PLO as well, but Syria particularly. When the Soviet was turned out of Egypt in 1971, she moved all her material into Syria and had a treaty with Syria. But in 1981 she had a very special close-knit treaty of friendship, in which one of the commentators remarked that Syria had become a satellite of the Soviet. And in the war last year, those some missiles that were taken out by the Israelis, of course, were all equipment from the Soviet. And there was a vast armament which was destroyed by the Israelis and has all been replaced briefly. And again, just the latest newspaper cuttings. March 83, Syria is another Russian outpost, says Weinberger. Yesterday, May the 14th, a week ago, Andropov raises Russia's status in Syrian eyes and goes on to say how Brezhnev didn't bother very much about Syria, how Andropov is showing a very real interest, how all the arms have been put back, and how very definitely Russia is pushing her way in from the north to have her say in the events in the Middle East. We aren't reaching just the final stage. Don't think that necessarily. I'm only indicating clearly what our brethren of 100 years ago, what would they have seen? Nothing in the Middle East at all. We emphasise Israel back in the land, but also King of the North, King of the South, all developing according to record. How remarkable that the Word of God could briefly put on record the shape of things which we see. We are right approaching the time when the Master will come.